Hello again there, folks. One of the concepts which I'm sure you'll have noticed, which is spreading itself across the political and the cultural landscape now, is the idea of whiteness, which of course it's a social justice. You'll have heard of white privilege, and they talk about the scourge of whiteness now, and they talk about it in the mainstream media, on the television and on the biggest platforms in the country. And that attitude is also reflected in cultural content as well. Now, to get into the nuts and bolts of the ideology a little bit here, this is something that I've seen growing like a tumor on the discourse. It starts off with somebody writing an obscure academic paper that you stumbled across back in 2012 or whatever, and then it just keeps growing and growing, and it gets to the point now where there's BBC Two, for example, have got a big program coming out on about it. You've got people like Afua Hirsch and Kehinde Andrews in Britain, and Kehinde Andrews, Ash Sarkar, so on. They're making a career out of peddling this stuff on the mainstream media. And so it gets to the point where even though you don't want to have to address it and take it on board, you feel like you kind of have to. And I knew this was going to happen as soon as I read a Lawrie Penny article in 2013 or something on white privilege. But just to get us a bit of a ease our way in here, let's have a look at what we're actually dealing with. This is a recent article at The Guardian, and it's typical. This is, there's no shock value here. This is becoming normalised now. That's kind of the point. Modern Europe was forged by an ideology of white supremacy that, regardless of our politics, is the mood music of our culture. Historically, it informed the direction of science, assumptions in philosophy, and crucially, what constitutes valuable or noteworthy art. The Church of England has begun to recognise that, and it's not alone. A growing number of white voices are vocalising the problem of whiteness. So whiteness is a problem, you see. That's what is, and this is, whether you like it or not, now what they're talking about in the media. And it genuinely beggars belief. And by the way, there was voices that this she's a white woman, but she's a Muslim convert. They aren't white either. They are something else, but this is on YouTube. But what I wanted to get into was that, note how expansive it is here. She's talking about philosophy, she's talking about science. And essentially, they're going back a lot longer than what people usually think of when they're confronted with this idea. So then further, she says, "This informs the stories that create our national sense of self, the ideas shaping our culture, and the debates over whose history becomes our common mythology. The conversation about whiteness may be underway, but earnest words shouldn't become a convenient distraction from concrete action." What is this concrete action then? Well, she leaves that out. And if you were to ask, it'd be something mundane like representation and politics. But again, their critique of whiteness, as we can see here, actually goes back about 500 years and encompasses all of modern Western thinking, art, economics, and politics. And just from the Wikipedia page on this, it says Princeton professor Nell Irvin Painter, in her 2010 book, The History of White People, says that the idea of whiteness is not just of biology, but also includes concepts of labour, gender, class, and images of personal beauty. The one on classical music, which is another, this one's a doozy, and this is one's called "It's Time to Let Classical Music Die," and they have this to say: "Western classical music is not about culture. It's about whiteness. It's a combination of European traditions that serve the specious belief that whiteness has a culture, one that is superior to all others. Its main purpose is to be a cultural anchor for the myth of white supremacy. In that regard, people of color can never truly be pioneers of Western classical music. The best we can be is exotic guests, entertainment for the white audiences, and an example of how Western classical music is more elite than the cultures of people of color." It's here that I'm going to preempt what a lot of people are going to be thinking when they read through this stuff. And it's going to be saying it as gently as I can, why don't we part ways? And to this, they'd say, there's no getting away from whiteness because it's spent 500 years forcing itself upon the world, as was stated in the Guardian article above. And I'm being objective as I can here, by the way, for now. I'm steelmanning their arguments because I'm going to melt them later. But what I have noticed while reading through their essays and talking points is that I've come across this thinking before, though in an inverted form, and whose sympathies lay with the Europeans. And that's not from the left, but from the far right. This idea that if you go back hundreds of years, Western man took a wrong turn and began the expansion and the materialism crept in, and then capitalism forced itself onto the world. And this idea that Faustian man was trapped in this soulless, materialistic, capitalist paradigm is something which somebody like René Guénon or Julius Evola or these controversial and much maligned by today's mainstream academics and philosophers and such would have it. But what's more interesting again is that on the left side of this, you can go back to the infamous Frankfurt School, and you'll see there. And this is just from the wiki article on Adorno. In works such as Dialectic of the Enlightenment and Negative Dialectics, Adorno and Horkheimer theorize that the phenomenon of mass culture has a political implication, namely that all of the many forms of popular culture are parts of a single culture industry whose purpose is to ensure the continued obedience of the masses to market interests. The Frankfurt School was, of course, tasked with finding out and investigating what had gone wrong with Marxist theory. Why hadn't the masses in Western Europe overthrown the masters and declared the Universal Brotherhood? The issue, the key, they found, was culture. After being chased out of Germany and landing in America, it became clear to Adorno that, at least in America, capitalism and culture had pretty much became the same thing. In post-modernity, capitalism itself has receded, and instead the culture, and now especially the people who carried it all on the backs, are the oppressor class, and all of it can be lumped into one big blob called whiteness, and whiteness is, in effect, the modern world. That's how this thing has played itself out. The difference between the traditionalists and neo-reactionary right is that they're looking at modernity from within and have scant regard for the outside. The postmodern left are looking from outside in, from a different, and you will hear them talking about this as well. You will hear them talking about in something like whiteness studies, their experiences. It's their subjective interpretations of whiteness and by that they mean capitalism plus the culture. And everything which Europeans have, they wouldn't like it framed like that, but essentially it's the existence of Europeans for the last 500 years. Most of the people in the media, the Ash Sarkars and Afua Hirshes, they didn't come up with any of this stuff, and they've simplified it to a moronic level, and they come over as grifters most people would wish just got lost. But what they also do is look back at a system of oppression which goes back throughout all of the modern world. So it isn't just that they're looking at how things are now, they're taking this way back. They are going to, not the Ash Sarkars, of course, the people with brains who come up with this stuff mainly on the American campus and in think tanks have actually gone back way further than people who complain about white privilege theory and whiteness studies actually think. Everything is a legacy of whiteness, and so therefore it has to be deconstructed. But this raises a question or two. Is free speech as a concept wrong? What about democracy? Is free speech just whiteness? What about individual rights? You see, if they're going to go all in on deconstructing Western civilization, which is essentially their argument, then they can justify doing pretty much whatever they want because their moral framework is operating outside of what we consider to be Western. Kehinde Andrews went to South Africa and blamed the failing infrastructure on whiteness, which was part of his book, The Psychosis of Whiteness. This is obviously insane, but why not? Rationalism itself was a creation of Europeans, and so it too can be written off as whiteness and cast aside. Property rights are a product of whiteness. A fair trial is whiteness. The rule of law is whiteness. Individual freedom is whiteness. Being against slavery is whiteness, according to the rules which these narratives perpetuate. You see, the modern post-Enlightenment world is a world of rights and laws and freedoms, and if they're in the business of tearing all of that down as a construct of whiteness, then they really don't have any reason to leave anything intact at all. A family could be dragged from their home and slaughtered on the streets. The police might arrive, but the very idea of a police force is a creation of whiteness, as are laws against people being butchered by a mob. Now, this may seem hyperbolic, even hysterical, but if classic music is a form of whiteness that needs to be purged, then the question is, what can't be purged or abolished as belonging to the category of whiteness? Well, let's get back to the idea of whiteness and colonialism and capitalism all operating in a symbiotic relationship. If the superstructure of the West is built on racism, oppression, and othering people of colour, why then are these ideas allowed to perpetuate themselves across the West? Why is there a demographic shift? Why, when we put these things together as a whole, has the modern West allowed for its core population to be cast as a metaphysical evil which must be deconstructed, while at the same time actively facilitating the physical replacement of that population? Something isn't right. But leaving aside some of the more controversial aspects of this and sticking with the theme of capitalism, the fact is global finance feels constrained by the mores and values of the West in modernity. So like some Frankenstein abomination, it's breaking through physical barriers, like the nation state, and breaking through philosophical constraints too, all in the name of finance and markets. Its core European population has become disposable, like the horse and cart being replaced by the steam engine. Finance now looks at the endless potential of Africa and Asia in a borderless world. And so from this perspective, Afua Hirsch and the rest of them, they aren't actually attacking the system. They're doing its bidding, and the system helps them every way it can via platforming and funding. The revolution is no longer about destroying capitalism, but to be its servants on a more equal footing than Europeans. Everybody in the world can be a consumer. Everybody in the world can work 12-hour night shift stickering boxes. The dream can be made real if only we get rid of the pale and stale and male corp identity of the West. Then they can be its slaves forever. During the Cold War, the Marxist strategy was to weaponize the Third World against the First. Armed with AK-47s, the revolution would begin in places like Vietnam and Cuba. Global capital's response was a simple one. Invite them all in and give them chicken nuggets and an iPhone. So leftist energies would then be redirected into so-called social justice and demands that special groups get their fair share of capitalism's treasure, not into questioning the structure of capitalism itself. The multinational and the billionaires who run it aren't really a problem for the left. The problem is that the boardroom isn't diverse enough. So, what's to be done? I noted before that when it suits these narratives, they step outside of what we might call the liberal paradigm. But if you then ask them what they actually want, then their answer is very benign, and it will be something like, we want equal pay, or we want to be on TV as much as you. And so all the stuff about 500 years of whiteness erasing their identity and othering them and destroying the world, takes a back seat, and what we get is the mundane. In other words, they're doing a Mott and Bailey. It's just about equality, you see. But hang on a minute. Isn't egalitarianism a product of whiteness? Is that not a philosophical idea born out of the very culture and people you've designated as a metaphysical evil to be dethroned so you can fulfill your destiny as highly productive members of the consumer proletariat? So like other groups before them, they step within the liberal frame when it suits, then step outside of it again to attack and deconstruct. The Europeans being attacked, though, are trapped within the bubble of liberalism and modern Western thought, and we've been bent over this rack for a long time. The critiques levelled at Europeans rely on the Europeans being more or less signed up to liberalism and egalitarianism to take it all seriously. Otherwise, why should anybody give a damn about them? Their supposed enrichment, their diversity, or whether they're represented and fawned over enough. You see, because I'm not a liberal, why should I care about their complaints at all? And what's more, it's pretty obvious they've rejected almost every other liberal value, which makes their complaints even more facile. Did Europeans colonise places? Yes. Do I feel bad about it? No. Oh, then you're a bad person. Under what morality or philosophy am I then a bad person? The one that you're deconstructing and calling oppressive? The one that is actually belongs in 500 years of oppressive whiteness? It's ridiculous. Why should I check my privilege? Social justice, equality, egalitarianism, humanism, civil rights, individualism, because it's rational? Is that where this moral framework stems from? They're all products of the Enlightenment and the modern West, and therefore creation of the very same white supremacy. They deconstruct Western liberal values by relying on Western liberal values to ground their own ideology. This is the grand arc of liberalism, collapsing in on itself under its weight and baggage, which it's accumulated over all these centuries. I touched earlier on reactionary thinkers such as Evola. How would a conversation between Julius Evola and Noel Ignatieff have played itself out? Ignatieff would have opened by rolling out his talking points about whiteness and oppression. Evola would probably, for various reasons, have viewed Ignatieff as being akin to some sort of snake creature, but more importantly, he'd have rejected the premise that any sort of equality was even desirable to begin with. If a Hindu complains that I enjoy a steak, I'm going to politely explain to him that I'm not a Hindu and don't have to abide by the rules of his religion. In the same way, I'm not a leftist or a liberal, so arguments about egalitarianism mean pretty much nothing to me. Does that seem harsh and uncaring? Does it seem like the morality of Tywin Lannister in Game of Thrones? Tywin is the epitome of master morality. He's powerful and he never apologises. But more importantly, he also understands that in order to survive in a harsh world, you have to dominate it. Sticking with the fantasy theme and the antithesis of Tywin might be Gollum from Lord of the Rings. With his slyness and low cunning, he ingratiates himself and plays on your sympathies, but really, he's out to rob you in your sleep and slit your throat. We see these Gollum creatures all over the media and politics these days, with their pick-and-mix selection of rhetorical tricks, cynically deployed egalitarianism because that's what's useful to them in the here and now. Their utter and complete lack of empathy to outrages like Rotherham, while they preach universalism. It's the behaviour of the gutter rat. It isn't just that I'm not sorry, it's that I find the very idea of being sorry or guilty repulsive. But more importantly, we see the re-emergence of the older dialectic between none other than the long-forgotten and much-maligned writings of reactionaries such as Evola. The decadence and lethargy brought about by hundreds of years of Western liberalism has brought us to the precipice, and the choice has to be made, and made soon. Does the future belong to the Tywin Lannisters, or the gutter rat sneak. Thanks for listening, folks, and I'll catch you later.